Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Nicholas Copernicus again, but this time rather than from a children's or general knowledge sort of coffee table book. This is from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So perhaps things will be a little bit different, especially the way things are read, with a bit more factual without the overlay of the general message, you know, that you've got to get through. Okay, this is Nicholas Copernicus, 1473 to 1543, 70 years, was a mathematician and astronomer who proposed the sun was stationary in the centre of the universe and the earth revolved around it. So that's a bit more it. Disturbed by the failures of Ptolemy's geocentric model of the universe to follow Aristotle's requirement of uniform circular motion of all celestial bodies, and determined to eliminate Ptolemy's equant, an imaginary point around which the body seemed to follow that requirement. So that gets it a little bit close to it. In the previous book, they also pointed out that the equant meant that the moon would become much larger and smaller as it came towards us. Copernicus decided that he could achieve his goal only through the heliocentric model. He thereby created the concept of a universe in which the distances of the planets to the sun bore a direct relationship with the size of their orbits. At the time, Copernicus' heliocentric idea was very controversial. Nevertheless, it was the start of a change of the way the world was viewed, and Copernicus can be seen as the initiator of the scientific revolution. So that's a key aspect trying to add explanations rather than work out from the theology to the observation, the observation to the theology. Life and works. Copernicus was born on the 19th of February, 1473, the youngest of four children of Nicholas Copernicus Sr. Well, this time we get the Latinization of their names, which was only Latinized later. A well-to-do merchant who moved to Turin from Krakow, and Barbara Walzernode, the daughter of a leading merchant family in Turin. So it sounds as though that he married into it. The city on the Vistula River had been an important inland port in the Hanseatic League. However, fighting between the Order of the Teutonic Knights and the Prussian Union in alliance with the Kingdom of Poland ended in 1466. West Prussia, which included Turin, was ceded to Poland, and Turin was declared a free city in the Polish kingdom. Thus, a child of a German family was subject to the Polish crown. So there you go. He was actually, in fact, to all intents, German. So this is something we didn't understand. A free city is sort of like a state, sort of a separate mini-state. So that's an interesting aspect of him. So we know a little bit more about him. He, in fact, was Dinky Die, German. His father died in 1843. The children's maternal uncle, Lucas Walzernode. So we now know that Barbara Walzernode was a leading merchant. The uncle took them into his protection. Walzernode was a very successful cleric. He was to become Bishop of Warne, Elmand in Germany, in 1486. He both and his direct education. In 1491, Copernicus enrolled in the University of Krakow. There is no record of him having obtained a degree, which is not unusual at the time, as he did not need a bachelor's degree for his ecclesiastical career, or even to study for a higher degree. But the University of Krakow offered courses in mathematics, astronomy, and astrology, all of which the university offerings, and Copernicus' interest was sparked, which is attested by his acquisition of books in the subject while in Krakow. So we now know he actually bought books on it, and they studied astrology. The interesting thing is that astrology was not outlawed by the church. In fact, the popes and people were very interested. In 1495, Watsonode arranged Copernicus's election as canon of the chapter of Frauenburg, in German, of the cathedral chapter in Weimar, an administrative position just below that of bishop. So this is just good old-fashioned nepotism, isn't it? And so it's a way of not promoting talent, I would expect. He assumed the post for 2 years, and his financial situation was secure for life. In the meantime, following his uncle's footsteps, Copernicus went to the University of Bologna, in Italy, I suppose, in 1496 to study canon law. While at Bologna, he lived with the astronomy professor, Domenico Maria Navarra. It's interesting that Maria is a woman's name, but she can have a second male name. He made his first astronomical observation. In addition, as Rosen noted, quote, in establishing close contact with Navarra, Copernicus met, perhaps for the first time in his life, a mind that dared to challenge authority. The most eminent ancient writer in the chosen field of study, end quote. Copernicus also gave a lecture on mathematics in Rome, which may have focused on astronomy. So it's interesting. It's a little bit more information. Copernicus' studies at Bologna provided an advantage that he did not have at Krakow. Teacher of Greek. Humanism began to infiltrate the Italian universities in the 15th century. As Grenadier remarked, quote, by the last quarter of the century, practically all universities had one or several humanists, and many of them are major scholars. So humanists, what is that? Antonio Corsi-Yusco, called Cordo, became the professor at Bologna in 1482, and added Greek several years later. So I wonder what humanists... you've got scholasticism. I wonder if humanists is actually a field of thought. I think that, look that up. Copernicus may have studied with him, for Copernicus translated into Latin the letters of 7th century Byzantine author Theophilus Simocatta from the 1499 edition of the collection of Greek letters produced by the Venetian humanist printer Altus Mantus. So there's a humanist and humanism. What does that mean? But there is a printer. So the humanists are getting into printing. It's an interesting aspect. Altus had dedicated his edition to Yurko. Copernicus had his translation printed in 1509. His only publication prior to On the Revolutions, the Revolutionists. It's important to note that Copernicus's acquisition of a good reading knowledge of Greek was critical for his studies in astronomy, because major works by Greek astronomers, including Ptolemy, had not yet been translated into Latin, a language of the universities. So that's a very interesting aspect. So if you went to Bologna, you learned Greek. Greek was a language of the humanists, and the printing was humanists, and so he actually got in ahead of the church translation to Latin. So it's really interesting. Copernicus left Bologna for Frauenburg in 1501 without having obtained his degree. The chapter then approved another leave of absence for Copernicus to study medicine in the University of Padua. The mega curriculum did not just include medicine or anatomy, and when Copernicus studied at Sarasi, noted that, quote, the reception of the 12th century Western Europe of Greek and Islamic technical astronomy and astrology fostered the development of medical astrology. The actual practice of medical astrology was greatest in the West between the 14th and 16th century. Astrology is taught in medical schools in Italy, so this is really important, that medicine not being formed properly, the study of medicine started the astrology. You had to study medicine, you had to understand astrology. Okay, medical astrology, I love that. Okay. The importance attached to the study of the stars in medieval medical education derived from the general and widely held belief that the heavenly bodies played an intermediate role in the creation of things where here below and continue to influence them throughout their existence. the actual uses of astrology in medical diagnosis and treatment by learned physicians were many and various. Astrological medicine is a vague and abstract term that can embrace all the following. First, according to the various celestial conditions. First, treatment they learned, physicians were many and various. Astrological medicine was vague and satisfactory in terms of all the following. First, pay attention to the supposed effect of astrological birth signs and signs at conception on the constitution and characters of patients. Second, to vary treatment according to the various celestial conditions. Third, to connect the doctrine of critical days of illness and the astrological features, usually the phases of the moon. And fourth, to predict and explain the epidemics with reference to planetary conjunctions and the appearance of planets for weather conditions. With that is absolutely amazing. So he studied a bit of astronomy, a bit of Greek, but then studied medicine, really got into the heavens. This is something we don't understand, and this is something left out of that book, that his study of astrology shows how the mixed world of the medieval mind came in. It's true that astrology required that medical students acquire some grounding in astronomy. Nevertheless, it's like the astronomer studied astrology while at Padua, the University of Padua. Copernicus did not receive his medical degree from Padua. The degree would have taken 3 years, and Copernicus had only been granted 2 years of leave absence for his chapter. Instead, he matriculated at the University of Ferrara, from which he obtained a doctorate in canon law. But he did not return to his chapter in Fromberg. Rather, he went to live with his uncle in the Episcopal Palace of Lidzbark-Warmitzki, Heelsberg in Germany. Although he made some astronomical observations, he was immersed in church politics, and after his elderly uncle became ill in 1507, Copernicus was his attending physician, the Rosen of good God. God isn't amazing, because he would be looking at the stars. Rosen reasonably conjectured that the bishop may have had hope that his nephew would be his successor, but Copernicus left his uncle because of his duties in Lisbon. So that's interesting. Warmitzki interfered with his continued pursuit of the studies of astronomy. He took up residence in his chapter in Fromberg in 1510 and stayed there for the rest of his life. Not that leaving his uncle and moving to Fromberg exempted Copernicus from continued involvement in administrative and political duties. He was responsible for the administration of various holdings, which involved heading and positioning funds, adjudicating disputes, attending meetings, keeping accounts and records. In response to the problems he found with local currency, he drafted an essay on coinage, which he deplored the displacement of the currency and made recommendations for reform. His manuscripts were consulted by the leaders of both Prussia and Poland in their attempts to stabilize the currency. He was a leader of the West Prussia in the war against the Teutonic Knights, which lasted from 1520 to 1525. He was a physician to the bishop. His uncle had died in 1512, and members of the chapter. He was consulting physician for notables in East and West Prussia. So he really was, it was technically Poland, but really what it was, something in a war ceded to Poland, but really a free city. Okay. Nevertheless, Copernicus began to work in astronomy on his own. Sometime between 1510 and 1514, he wrote an essay that would become known as Commentarius, that introduced his new cosmological ideas, the heliocentric universe, and he sent copies to various astronomers. He continued making astronomical... Sorry about that one. Wind here. He continued making astronomical observations whenever he could. Hampered by the poor position of observations in Fronbrook, his many pressing responsibilities as canon. Nevertheless, he kept working on his manuscripts on the revolutions. He also wrote what is known as a letter against Werner, a critique of John Werner's letter concerning the motion of the eighth sphere. Copernicus claimed that Werner erred in his calculation of time and his belief that before Ptolemy, the movement of fixed stars was uniform, but Copernicus' letter did not refer to his cosmological ideas. We don't quite understand what that is. In 1539, a young mathematician named Gregor Johann Rectus from the University of Wittenberg came to study with Copernicus. Rectus bought Copernicus's books in mathematics in part to show Copernicus the quality of printing that was available in the German-speaking cities. He published an introduction to Copernicus's idea in the Rota Prima. So this is interesting that printing is amazing, and the humanists and studying Greek before the information was in Greek before it was translated into Latin. So he sort of got access to the ideas before they went through. He published an introduction to Copernicus' idea, Narrata Prima. Most importantly, he convinced Copernicus to publish On the Revolution. Rictus oversaw the most printing, most of the printing of the book. And on May 1543, Copernicus held a copy of the finished work on his deathbed. Okay, well, there you go. Astronomical ideas and writings. Pre-Copernican astronomy. The classical astronomy followed principles established by Aristotle. Aristotle accepted the idea there were four principal elements. Well, really, there were five. Earth, water, air, and fire. Aristotle also had ether. He put the earth at the center of the universe and contended that the elements were below the moon, which were the closest celestial body. There were seven planets, or wandering stars, because they had a course through the zodiac in addition to travelling around the Earth. The Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter. Beyond that, there were fixed stars. The physical elements, according to Aristotle, moved vertically depending on the heaviness of gravity. Celestial bodies were not physical, but the fifth element, or quintessence, whose nature was to move in perfect circles around the Earth, making a daily rotation. Aristotle envisioned the Earth as the true centre of the circles, and the orbs carrying the heavenly bodies around it in the motion of uniform that is unchanging. So quintessence, that's interesting, a fifth element to come up there. So there's the earthly, four earthly, and the quintessence. But observers realised that the heavenly bodies did not move as Aristotle postulated. The Earth was not the true centre of the orbits, and the motion was not uniform. Most obvious problem was that the outer planets seemed to stop, move backwards in retrograde motion for a while, and then continued forward. By the 2nd century, when Ptolemy compiled the Almagest, this common name for Ptolemy's name's Syntaxis is derived from the Arabic title. Oh dear. So Ptolemy wrote in Greek, putting it together. The astronomers had developed the concept of eccentric and heavenly bodies moved around a central point. Ptolemy added a point on a straight line opposite the eccentric, which is called the equalizing point, or equant, and around the point the heavenly bodies moved uniformly. Moreover, unlike Aristotle's model, Ptolemy's Almagest did not describe a unified universe. The ancient astronomers who followed Ptolemy, however, were not concerned if his system did not describe the true motions of the heavenly bodies. Their concern was to save the phenomena, that is, give a close approximation to where the heavenly bodies should be at a given point in time. And in an age without professional astronomers, let alone the telescope, Ptolemy did a good job of plotting the courses of heavenly bodies. Not all Greek astronomical ideas followed the geocentric system. Pythagorean suggests that the Earth moved around a central fire, the hot sun. Archimedes wrote that Aristus of Salamis actually proposed the Earth rotated daily and revolved around the sun. Well, there you go. So this is Archimedes wrote Aristus. So this is interesting aspect. And the Pythagoras said the Earth moved around a central fire, not the sun. Isn't that amazing? During the European Middle Ages, the Islamic world was the centre of the astronomical thought and activity. During the 9th century, which is the 9th century is anything with 800, so it would be 801 to 899. Several aspects of Ptolemy's solar theory was recalculated. Ibn al-Haytham, the 10th, 12th century, wrote a scathing critique of Ptolemy's work. Ptolemy assumed an arrangement that cannot exist, and the fact that this arrangement produces in his imagination the motions that belong to the planets does not free him from the error he committed in his assumed arrangement, for existing motions of the planets cannot be the result of an arrangement that is impossible to exist. The Arabs just didn't translate it. They ripped the shit out of it. Schirwell and Nuremberg stressed the 13th century Maharaga school was also important in finding errors and correcting Ptolemy. The method of the Maharaga planetary model was to break up the equivalent motion of Ptolemy's models into two or more components of uniform circular motion, physically with the uniform rotation of spheres that together control the direction and distance at the centre of the epicycle. So, Ptolemy didn't actually have the spheres. The Arabs added these secondary spheres. So that it comes to lie in nearly the same position as it would have in the Ptolemy motion, as always moved uniformly with respect to the equant. They found that Copernicus uses devices that have been developed by Maharaga astronomers Nasr al-Din Su and Marid al-Din al-Yuri. Look, I'm going to spell this to you. Q-U-T-B. How do you pronounce that? Qutb al-Din al-Shirazi and Ibn al-Shatar. In addition, Raghib, 2005, has shown the theory of the innermost planets presented by Wigglebus that enabled Copernicus to convert the planets to eccentric models had been developed by the 15th century Samarkand-trained astronomer Al-Khwarizmi. So the Arabs did not just simply translate the Greek text, they modified it. Renaissance humanism did not necessarily promote natural philosophy, but the emphasis on mastery of classical language and texts on the side effect of promoting the sciences. So, really, humanism is a pre-scientific revolution, whatever that means. So we've got to understand that. So, you can see science always existed and the Arabs did nothing. The Arabs added more, and we've got this new idea of humanism. George Perbach, 1462-23 to 1461, and Jonas Müller, studied Greek for the purpose of producing the outline of the Ptolemaic astronomy. But at the time Rochimus finished the work in 1463, it was an important commentary on the Almbas as well, pointing out, for example, that Ptolemy's lunar theory did not accord with the observations. He noted that Ptolemy showed that the moon would be at various times twice as far from the Earth as at other times, which should make a common moon appear twice as big. At the time, moreover, there was active debate over Ptolemy's deviation from Aristotle's requirement of circular motion, which is go. So it's not that Ptolemy was accepted. It was debated by the, ridiculed by the Arabs and debated there. The Commentarius. It is impossible to date when Copernicus first began to espouse the heliocentric theory. He had done so during his lecture in Rome. Such a radical theory would have occasioned comment, but there was none, so it is likely he adopted it after 1500. Further, Corvius, who helped him print the Latin translation in 1508-9, expressed admiration for his knowledge of astronomy, so that Copernicus' concept may still have been traditional at this point. His first heliocentric writing was in the Commentarius. It's a small manuscript that was circulated but never printed. We do not know when he wrote this, but Professor Krakauer catalogued his in his books in 1514 and made reference to manuscripts of six leaves expounding the theory of an author who asserts the Earth moves whilst the Sun stands still. Copernicus probably adopted the heliocentric theory sometime between 1508 and 1514. Rosen, 1971, suggests that Copernicus quotes interest in determining planetary positions in 1512 to 14 may reasonably link to his decisions to leave his uncle's Episcopal palace in 1510 and to build his own outdoor observatory in 1513. So this is a piece of new news. He didn't just climb up to the the cathedral, he built his own outside the observatory. In other words, it was a result of a period of intense concentration on cosmology that facilitated by his leaving his uncle and attendant focus on the church, politics and medicine. Now, we now know that medicine relied on astrology. It's impossible to know exactly why Copernicus began to espouse the heliocentric cosmology. Despite his importance in the history of philosophy, there is a paucity of primary sources on Copernicus. His only astronomical writings were Copernicus and Letters Against Werner and the Revolutions. He published his translation of Theophrastus' letters and wrote various versions of his treatise on coinage. Other writings related to diocesan business, as do most of the few letters that survive. Sadly, the biography of Rheticus, which should have proved by the scholars with enormous amounts of information, has been lost. Therefore, many of the asks the most interesting questions about Copernicus' ideas and works have been the result of conjecture and inference, and we can only guess why Copernicus adopted the heliocentric system. That's a much more satisfactory by saying, here's my sweeping view, and here's my sweeping view, the other thing. Most scholars believe the reason Copernicus rejected the Ptolemaic cosmology was because Ptolemy's equant. They assume this was because of what Copernicus wrote in Commentarius. Quote, yet the widespread planetary theory is advanced by Ptolemy and most other astronomers, although consistent with numerical data, seemed likewise to present no small difficulty. For these theories were not adequate unless they also conceived certain equalizing circles in which the planet appears to move at all times with uniform velocity, neither on its different sphere or about its own epicenter. Therefore, having become aware of these defects, I often considered whether there could perhaps be found a more reasonable arrangement of circles from which every apparent irregularity would be derived while everything itself would move uniformly, as required by the rule of perfect motion. So you realise that the rule of perfect motion, which is he was still enthralled by Aristotle. He was saying that Ptolemy had gone the wrong way, let's go back, and he still had spheres, spheres, but he had a rearrangement of perfect circles. Gaudu has possibly maintained that while the initial motivation of Copernicus was dissatisfaction with the equant, that dissatisfaction may have impelled him to observe other violations of uniform circular motion. And those observations, not the rejection of the equidna itself, led to the heliocentric theory. Blumberg has pointed out that the mobility of the Earth may have been reinforced by similarity of its spherical shape with those of heavenly bodies. As a rejection of the equidna suggests a return to Aristotle's demand for true uniform circular bodies of, so he is counter Ptolemy. He's saying that Ptolemy is too advanced. It's unlikely that Copernicus adopted the heliocentric model because the philosophy is popular amongst Renaissance humanists, like Neoplatonism and Hermetism, compelled him in that direction. Nor should we attribute Copernicus' desire for uniform circular motions to aesthetic needs, for this idea was philosophically not aesthetic. Copernicus replacing the equid and epicycles, cyclates, made his system more complex than Ptolemy's. More importantly, we should bear in mind what Sidder and Nierenberg asserted, quote, Copernicus arrived at the heliocentric theory by careful analysis of planetary models, and as far as it is known, he was the only person of his age to do so, and if he chose to adopt it, he did so on the basis of equally careful analysis. So this is an important thing. He is an isolated person. In Commentarius, Copernicus listed assumptions that he believed solved the problems of ancient astronomy. He stated the Earth is only the centre of gravity and the center of the moon's orbit, and all the spheres encircle the sun, which is close to the center of the universe. So the idea is that the universe, you know, things orbit around the center of the universe. It's interesting. So the sun is the center. The sun does not have gravity. It just happens to be at the center of the universe. The universe is much larger than previously assumed. The Earth's distance to the sun is a small fraction of the size of the universe. And the apparent motion of the heavens and the sun created by the motion of the Earth, and the apparent retrograde motion of the planets created by the Earth's motion. Although Copernican model maintained epicycles moving along the different, they explained retrograde motion in the Ptolemaic model. Copernicus correctly explained the retrograde motion of the planets was only apparent, not real. The appearance was due to the fact the observers were not at rest at the centre. The work dealt very briefly with the order of planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter and Saturn, the only planets that could be observed with the naked eye. The triple motion of the Earth, the daily rotation, an annual revolution at the centre, the annual revolution and its inclination, that causes the Sun to be in motion. The motions of the equinox and revolutions of the Moon around the Earth and the revolution of the five planets around the Sun. I'm just going to finish reading at that point. 31 minutes. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.